Sati. I've been here many, many times. I've lost count, actually, like many of us here. But it must be close to 50 times, maybe 45, I don't know. But I still love to come. We all love to come. But I also, I must admit, I love to go. Not that I want to say goodbye to Madhavan. I really genuinely feel there's a point where you feel you've taken a lot and you really are eager to practice what you've learned, you know, spiritually for the self. But also, you know, to go back onto the service field and try out things which we've spent our time here in Madhavan. And this morning I just going to share a few thoughts about respect. I think that it was termed building a culture of respect. Because perhaps it's something which is a bit close to my heart, the whole sort of subject of respect. And if I reflect on my life, before I became Baba's child, I think everyone in this room was quite a snatcher. I was a wanderer in a way, and I, at quite a young age, I suppose, I left home and I wandered around the world, and I spent, I think it was 3.5 years, something like that, living in all sorts of religious communities in all parts of the world. And I spent time with Buddhists, I spent some time with Sikhs, I spent time with Hindus, time with yogis, you know, all sorts of communities. And really when I reflect on it, you know, what was I looking for? Obviously I was an old soul saying, Baba, where are you? Like all of us. But in one sense I think I was looking for my truth, there's no doubt. Even since a small child, I had this idealism about a community, if I can say, just like a sense of harmony, a sense of unity, and living in a community of people that genuinely give respect to each other. And when I look at my life also, I noticed that since I was young, I had a real reaction to things of disrespect. And I spent quite a bit of time in my youth, and when I was at university, on the street demonstrating, you know, for all forms of social justice, which got me into a bit of trouble, I might say. I won't go into this morning, but things like apartheid, and at that time, you know, Australia was in a war against Vietnam, and I was always out, you know, demonstrating against things. But I think when I became Baba's child, when I became a Brahmin, I always feel that it was like coming home. You know, becoming Baba's child is like coming home to where I really belong. And I have a feeling that one of the most powerful things in the human soul is the sense of belonging. You know, I think, you know how peace is intrinsic to our sort of psychology. I think belonging is too. It's so deep in us. And one of the things, I think perhaps especially all of us who, you know, come from all corners of the globe, is we felt sort of alienated and disconnected. And coming to Baba is finding not only, you know, my father and this eternal relationship that the soul has looked for, a relationship of pure love, but I also find this family, this incredible family of souls that have a similar feeling to me, that there can be a perfect society and we can live together in harmony and unity. And that's why I think so deep in the psyche of the soul, we have such a memory of living in harmony and unity. And it's a little bit why Brahmins are very idealistic, that when there's not harmony and unity, there's something, it just doesn't feel right, does it? There's something. Even though on an intellectual level we all know it takes a long time to develop true harmony and unity, but when it's not right, there's something which is uncomfortable inside. And I think that we've all, in my sort of mind, we've all travelled around the cycle, and You know, we've been on a long, long journey. I don't know whether you feel it, but sometimes I love to sit and just sort of feel how the soul's been on this amazing journey to be back to this time. And we've lived in all sorts of systems, and shall we say, from all sorts of communities, extended families. And we've got so much experience of living with groups of people. And I think that, you know, the golden age is such a deep memory for us, the pure kingdom. And I often feel that, what is a kingdom? A lot of these days when we first find Baba, and Baba says, you know, children, you know, there'll be a kingdom in the golden age. We can, I don't know about you, but some of us react. Because in this world, when we extrapolate that through our sanskaras of our experience of this world, there's so much sort of corruption in kingdoms that we feel, But actually, the kingdom is really the most pure form of system that human beings can live together with great love and respect. And one of the reasons, I think, is that the kingdom is in a way a combined form of three things. It's pure family, if I can say, pure religion or pure way of life, and thirdly, pure government and pure law. But in this world, they're all separate. Family separate from government, from religion. But the kingdom is like this extraordinary system whereby we all live together in a huge family, in a sense. And Lakshmi Narayan are like the parents. And what is the law? The law is the actions. Their actions are just an example. And we can say that religion is almost their virtues, and it's their virtues and their actions that sustain a whole community. They give tremendous respect to every soul, and every soul has such deep love. I remember once in the Satsangulis, people were saying that in the golden age, when you find a really beautiful piece of fruit, you know, as you hear in trance messages, bits of fruit are so huge and so yummy. You know? The first thought of mine is that I just want to take it to Lakshmi Narayan. It's like there's such a deep love there. And I remember once I was hearing Radhakan in my early days when, I don't know, it would have been in the late 70s sometime, and in those days, and sometimes you pick up the Guru Shikha, you know, which is the very top of the mountain. And this particular day we went up there and we all went to dance, you know, like deities, and we were all sort of prancing around the place. And what happened was there was a young brother from London, and I think he was only 15 or 16 at the time, and he went in trance. And that used to happen a lot more in those days. And he was away, you know, like we were watching, and he just was in another planet completely. And when he came back, you know, it was quite an emotional scene. I can remember it quite well because he just went to the golden age and he was there. And I can remember him, you know, just saying that you just can't imagine how beautiful that place is. I think we extrapolate the atmosphere and the systems of this world to that world. It's just, it's a world where he was like saying, it's palpable, love is palpable, and respect is palpable. It's just so, it's just an atmosphere of so much purity and beauty. And I can remember when he came back, he was in tears, you know, he was just in so much intoxication. And you know, a lot of us also had a few moist eyes just looking at the joy of that time, because it's like human souls all living together as individuals and yet with absolutely total unadulterated respect for one another, love and respect. And that's the memory that's sort of scored deep inside all of us. But when we come into the proper age, we start to experience all different systems. Even though I think many times a lot of the kings and so on were very benevolent, I think there was a lot of benevolent kings. I'm sure there's a lot of very unbenevolent, if there is such a word, benevolent kings. And you know, there were dictatorships and theocracies, rulership by religious leaders, and then, you know, all the isms, socialisms and communisms, and you know on the tree, all those sorts of things. And one of the things which I've always loved in Baba's knowledge is the picture of the tree. Because when I first saw it, it sent me two really powerful messages. The first message was that we're one human family. That feels so right, doesn't it? We're one human family. That is fact, it's truth. And yet when I look at the world now, you'd think it's anything but. There's just a world riddled by conflict on almost every level. But what I really loved about the tree too was in one picture there was respect for all the different belief systems and religions. And that, I think, that's the samskara we Brahmins have. We Brahmins sort of know that it's right, even though I'm a BK and I follow this and I feel this to be true. To me, one of the expressions of spirituality is the ability to respect someone who has a completely different belief from me. And not a superficial form of respect. It's a very genuine feeling. And if one of the great marks of spirituality, I feel, is the sense of, you know, real acceptance for everyone. You know, really deep acceptance for the soul, so that we're one family. I remember once talking to the foreigners, and he was saying, you know, why are the foreigners so important? Why is our role important? Because he was saying that, you know, God will only be recognized when some from every religion, every culture, every sort of ethnic group, every profession will say, my Baba. And that's why, you know, this whole group is really, really important. And so it's like we go to all these different systems in which we live. And as we do, I think disrespect, division, conflict seems to increase and increase until we know by the end of the Iron Age it's just that, you know, when ego is such an extreme, we just can't respect anybody. And this is why I think Baba, one of the systems that Baba creates to bring back this golden age sense of harmony and unity is a term which I'm not sure who coined. I think it was like he creates a respectocracy. You know, we have the democracy, the theocracy. It's almost like Baba creates a whole system of us living together, all based on the art, this extraordinary art of giving regard to the other. Which is the great demonstration, I feel, of a truly spiritual person. I remember once I was talking with Wadi, who's in Miami. I think you all know Wadi. And we were talking about this, you know, what is the greatest need in the human soul? And I was saying it's love. And, you know, I always feel that the fundamental need and desire is love. And when that's pinched, that's the key to contentment. I always feel that. I was talking about that the other night. That when that fundamental desire is satisfied, it's like then all other desires let go. If that fundamental desire isn't experienced, there's just shopping list of desires in the soul. If love isn't quenched, there's just the constant search to be recognized, to be acknowledged, to be respected, to be, all that stuff is in there. But what she was saying, that once in Miami, they asked a whole group of people, what do you feel is most important in your life? And they said respect, the need for respect. And it's interesting, isn't it? Because we live in a world where we find it very challenging to respect ourselves. And so the dependence on others respecting me is really huge. And I remember one thing that Baba said many years ago, which stuck in my mind, and that was that respect is the greatest authority. I love it. Respect is the greatest authority. And what Baba was meaning by that is that when I give respect to you, well, naturally I become an authority or a leader. And really when you look at the world today, what is the sort of the hallmark of leadership? It's like leaders demand respect, you know, don't they? I'm the leader, so you must respect me. And what is the big crisis in the world? The crisis is leadership. No one respects leaders today. Because we don't have qualities, and you can't demand respect. It's just like a spiritual law. Whereas, what I think God is teaching us is pure authority, right? Leaders which are truly respected are the ones who give respect. And actually the mark of pure authority or pure leadership, true leadership, I think, is constantly giving respect, giving respect, giving more respect. Just think when in the old days, not only then, just now, when Baba meets us, what's the whole feeling when you meet Baba? It's so loving, and yet Baba gives respect to all. He never forgets anyone. He always says, oh, those up the back, you know, acknowledges them, and he acknowledges just, he just gives so much regard. And I can remember the old days when we sometimes used to meet Baba in this hall or the small hall or even in Om Shanti Bhavan. And we'd sit up all night. I think, if I can say what is my memory of Brahman life that's sweetest, I would think it was just watching Baba meeting the children. And that was just the most fantastic education of how to respect everyone. Because each night Baba would have some of the eight jewels come in front of him, some of the 108, some of the 16,108, some of the 900,000, and some of the rest. And his attitude of regard was just so great. His sense of respect pulls out my own sense of self-respect. And I really used to love that. And it's almost like Baba's authority. The reason we love Baba so much is because Baba's ability to give regard to every soul, and yet every single one of those souls who sits in front of Baba has flaws and has weakness. But does Baba focus on it? No, he doesn't. And what he does is he focuses on what's good, he focuses on that sort of original part, and because of that, you know, creates that sort of strength of relationship. And so I think that, you know, really even in the Brahmin family, I've often thought, you know, Dadiji, I've always found personally for me a wonderful example of being a leader, you know, when he's talking about this world where no one respects leaders. And why? He gives regard to everyone. I once saw Dadiji walk out of her room to come to Amrit Vela. And I saw someone approach her like 4 in the morning and started talking in her ear. Well, I don't know, but I think a lot of people say, listen, you know, it's fine, it's 4:15, but I just have a bit of peace now and I'll talk to you later even. But no, she stopped and she listened. And I noticed that when she listens, you become her world. You know, she doesn't sort of look all, gosh, you know, it's 4:00, or, you know, it's like every bit of thought, body language and everything is just giving regard to you, and so that when you leave that meeting, even if it's 30 seconds, you feel better. You know, it's like your interaction has been uplifting, has uplifted somebody. And I think that's, you know, really an extraordinary example of that, is that inner attitude. But, you know, how do we create a sort of an atmosphere of respect, or as they say, a respectocracy. We all know that the first step always is to create a respectocracy in myself, you know. I don't know about you, but I still believe after all the years I've been a BK, is that the biggest challenge for all BKs is to create and sustain in all scenes of the Dharma my self-respect. What do you agree? I really think it is. You know, I think that, in a sense, once I remember Baba saying that soul consciousness is just regaining all my self-respect. And I've observed personally that many of us make so much effort to become soul-conscious. You know, we practice, you know, that I'm a soul and I'm this tiny little point of light and I'm this and I'm that, you know, and I practice and I practice and I practice. And yet sometimes I sit down and I think, I've made so much effort and yet I don't think I've got that far. Who felt that sometimes? And you know, one of the reasons I think that we've practiced it, we know it, we love it, we believe it. And we're even inculcated some of that, but I think we still hold on to the identity of the soul. We practice being the form of the soul, the nature of the soul, immortal, eternal. But we still identify as being weak. And even the other night, Buddha was sort of saying, you know, he was talking about this identification with the negativity and weakness in the soul, wasn't he? When he was talking about my sanskaras, you remember how Baba was saying, you know, shall I tell you something? Shall I tell you something? And then, you want me to tell you something? He's so good. He's such an entertainer when he does it. Because he's aimed at this carrot. They're all saying, oh, brother, we're sitting on the edge of our feet. And then he just says that his identification, and to me, the mark of a truly knowledgeable soul is when I shift identifying with my weakness, with the negativity, with the blueprint of sanskaras in the soul, which is of the second half of the cycle, and I identify with my pure original state. No matter how impure and weak my sanskaras is, my duty of a knowledgeable soul is to say, actually, the reality of me is the blueprint of pure sanskaras. That's really who I am. I can separate myself from my insecurity, my fears. That's who I am. That's where I see myself. I get stuck. I'm stuck in this place of identifying with what's old rather than what's original. And I think that, you know, it needs so much courage to move along this journey and, you know, to begin to, as we know, to let go this sense of inferiority that we often have. I often think that most Brahmins don't sort of suffer from superiority mostly. You know, we suffer from that sense of inferiority, but soul consciousness is truly the vision of equality. And sort of the addiction to negative thinking and the sort of the ego of putting myself down, because it is ego. And we know, though, over a period of time, I think we begin to nurture in myself a sense of self-love. And I often used to have a criteria for myself that, you know, it means in this journey, it's inevitable that I will make some mistakes, whether small or big. We all do. Baba often says this even. But what's important, sometimes I think, yeah, I shouldn't make the mistake again, but what's important is how do I react to myself when I make a mistake? Even a failure, I do something and it just doesn't work. How do I react to myself? And that's what I often used to watch. If I'm criticized, I make a mistake, there is a failure, do I fall into these old patterns of thinking, this self-talk that I'm no good, and I, reinforce and sustain these habits of disrespect. Because we know that if I'm to build a culture of respect, to be a part of it, I have to first learn how to give it to myself. And this is such a deep lesson. And I think, you know, if I look at the things that I focused on in my Brahman life, I'd say more than anything, it's probably setting myself the sort of the, how can you put it, the target, so to speak. No matter what thing comes in front, no matter what is said, no matter what happens, what's important is that I don't let go of my self-value. And that's the gift that Baba has given me. And that is truth. And in a sense, when I let go of my self-value, it's like I really do forget Baba at that time, and I start to identify with what's old rather than what Baba has told me, which is true and original. Because I think that when I lay a platform of the respectocracy for the self, then it's like I can begin to, you know, really give true respect to others. And I think that we all have the aim, and sometimes, you know, in the Brahmin family, if we observe where there's not respect, and as we know, you know, that none of us come here perfect as much as we would love to, you know, sometimes there's frustration or whatever, that, you know, Baba says one thing and obviously something different is happening. Just like building respect in myself, it takes time. I think creating this family where there's real regard, I think, you know, it also takes time. I remember once I was in Melbourne many, many years ago, and Daddy Prakashmani was there. I can't even remember what year it was, I'm hopeless at years, but there was a brother whom Elizabeth will remember from San Francisco called Australia. Why did he leave his body? Anyway. Really, that early one. Well, it was a long, long time ago. But I remember we were sitting in the classroom and he asked Daddy, why is there unity in the Brahma Kumaris? Why was it that when Brahma Baba died that the whole thing didn't fall to pieces? And he told a story about his own research, because Harold was a psychologist. And he had done a lot of research into religious and spiritual groups and communities. It was really interesting. And he told Daddy how all his research, and he'd done like 70 groups in America, I remember him saying this, that all his research showed that these communities often lasted about, you know, I think he said 12 to 16 years. And what happened was that there'd be some charismatic leader, some spiritual personality, and a small group would gather around that person, and they never had anything but their love and their devotion and their commitment, like there was nothing. But after 5 or 6 years, suddenly a whole lot more people started to come, and as they started to come, they brought a lot of wealth with them, a lot of money and a lot of facilities. It seemed to see that slowly over the next 5 or 6 years, that began to corrupt the original sort of truth or spiritual thing that started it. And began so much infighting and conflict that after, 14 to 16 to 18, 18 years, the whole thing just collapsed. So he was saying to Daddy, well, Daddy, it's now, it was nearly 50 years or something that your thing, the Brahma Kumaris, has been going, why is it? And what Daddy D said was that, she said, the original group of sisters, the daddies, have so much love and respect for each other. They have sort of, their respect is solid. And they listen to each other. And actually I remember Daddy saying that when she has an idea, she consults with that group and gets all their ideas, and they have a sort of a consensus. It's like this give and take of respect. And she said, because ultimately they have so much love and respect for Baba and Baba's past about their own desires or their own need for, acknowledgement or whatever. And that's why, that's the foundation in which the Brahmin family is really sitting. The unity and the respect of the seniors, and it's like a culture. But I think that, we go through phases, and when we take spiritual growth, when we come to Baba, and what are we like? We're just like, newborn babies, and we're just so intoxicated when we find Baba, and we see everyone as an angel, Everyone's an angel. If you have that experience, you just see everyone is absolutely divine, and it's just wonderful. And sometimes I think some souls come to Baba and instantly recognize Baba. Some I think almost recognize the family. It's almost like it takes time to recognize Baba, but there's a feeling that this is the family I've looked for, memory of last Kalpa or something like this. And it's like a honeymoon. We're all on a honeymoon. And, everything is really wonderful. Then I think it's a beautiful phase, perhaps we're still a bit innocent. And perhaps, you know, my understanding's a bit superficial, and I'm just beginning. And I think the next phase that we often develop with the Brahman family is perhaps what we could call the phase of familiarity. It's like, it's a part of relationship, isn't it? That first, we just get to know someone on a superficial level. The second, we become a little bit familiar with them. And I think all of us have experience in some form or another. There's Baba, I want to help in Baba's path. I want to be a part of Baba's service. And so, you know, I offer myself and I start to work with Brahmins. And what will happen, as we all know, is that occasionally my buttons are pressed by somebody, as they say. Sometimes in a tiny way, and sometimes in a huge way, someone presses a button. And, you know, I don't know whether you can remember when that first happened. Sometimes there's a little bit of a shock. Oh, I never thought this would happen in the Brahman family. Because we've got this idealism of what we know is right. And not only are my buttons pressed, but I press other people's buttons too. And that's also where this sort of process begins to happen. And what I feel personally is that, you know, the Brahman family is the vehicle for me to learn about my own impurity, especially in terms of human relationships. So the second half of the cycle, I've collected a whole lot of impurity. And most of my sanskaras, I think, are based on interaction with others. And what the Brahman family does, it's a perfect vehicle to emerge in front of me and say to change. And this is how it should be. It's not that it's wrong. It's actually a part of the process that the family will draw out of me my weakness so I can learn and change. But there's two responses to that that I find is that some sort of understand this process and say, yes, the family is this extraordinary teaching mechanism for me to observe my own weakness. Others start to react, to blame, to criticize, and all that sort of stuff comes up. And sometimes all the wisdom does never really learn that this is the process and it is the family that is the vehicle to emerge these things so I can learn deeply about who I am. My feeling often is that, you know, how do I conquer ego? How do I really, what is it even? It's such a subtle, slippery thing, isn't it? Sometimes I just feel, live in the heart of the Brahman family. And that is absolutely the message Baba has given us, because I will be challenged and challenged and challenged, and the Gyani soul will learn and learn and learn, and it will create this beautiful, I find an old Brahman is so fragrant, because they've got this beautiful sort of gentle humility, because they've been through many things, and they're sort of a wise, there's something really attractive I find about it. And others will just yell and scream and just say, this is not right, this is not right, and constantly aren't sort of aware that this is actually the process for me to learn. And what I've observed, so many lessons to learn, you know, about, you know, giving respect and how, you know, the areas of disrespect that I've developed. And one of the things I think it brings out is my relationship with authority. You know, I think it's a very interesting relationship because in the second half of the cycle, we've been subject to many impure forms of authority. You know, leaders and kings and gurus and parents, all sorts of things, teachers, that aren't pure authority, that have been abusive. And so some souls, not all, are deeply mistrusting almost of anyone who sits in a seat of authority. Deeply mistrusting. A little bit mistrusting. Because we've been damaged a bit. And so anyone who's making decisions in my life, there's a little bit of wariness. And it's something that we really have to, I think, begin to learn about how, you know, to sort of give respect and to also take respect in that way and observe my own reactions, because sometimes almost some people, whenever there's anyone in a position of authority, there's almost feelings of opposition. Not for everybody, but for some, there's sort of deep feelings of opposition or disagreement or whatever. I remember once, Baba, I heard someone say that Brahma Baba said, to keep the property of his children, he would give them responsibility. Because he knows whenever you're in a role of responsibility, people will challenge you. It's human nature at the end of the cycle. And we've got to learn how to deal with that too. But we've also got to come to terms that now Baba is a pure authority. Baba has no vested interest in manipulation or control. Baba only wants us to become pure and happy once again. And so, yeah, we trust Baba, but he's taken a part of Baba's system to trust his instruments, even if they're not perfect. And they're not. And that's something we've got to learn how to do that, you know, to give respect and trust those who Baba's put in a role of responsibility. It's learning about, that's one thing, learning about, you know, dealing with those in positions of responsibility. But one thing I've learned a lot myself is about controlling nature. And I think one thing that creates really, if I can put subtle negative feelings in others or the family, is controlling nature. And you know, I can tell you honestly, I would never, at first I never thought, you know, I was like that. And yet, it's such a subtle thing. The way we develop mechanisms to get my own way. And this also breaks down the sense of harmony and unity in the family. And I think that sometimes we confuse responsibility and control. We think, oh, I'm responsible, that means I'm in control. But I think that, you know, even mentally, when we're always sort of controlling people, we pick up that feeling from us. Whereas what Baba wants us to do is have good wishes and pure feelings. It's sort of not supposed to be like this, this one should be doing this, this one shouldn't behave in this way, you shouldn't speak like this. You know, sometimes I sort of call it like being a, you know, a spiritual policeman in a way. I'm always sort of telling people what to do. How do we control? You know, controlling behavior can be very subtle. And even a form of control is to withdraw from things. On the surface, that seems like someone showing humility. Actually, one of the main forms of control is say, it's almost like saying, if it's not my way, sorry, I'm out of here. I don't want to participate. And so it's a very controlling behavior when I sort of say, no, I'm not going to cooperate. Even getting upset is very controlling behavior. What do children do if they want their way? What do? Little children. They throw a tantrum at their feet. Not very good at tantrum. And you know, sometimes as adults we carry on that. We might put a tantrum and we get very upset, and it's once again, it's not my way, and you know, oh, I get very, very hurt. There's all sorts of subtle ways that we try to control things, and that influences the atmosphere of unity and harmony, the atmosphere of respect that I really want. So there's controlling behavior. And I think even, as we know, there's the many forms of ego, I think, manifest in our relationships. You know, the ego is seeing defect. To me, that's one of probably the main way I can tell about ego. One of the main ways for me is just that my vision towards others. You know, when I can see virtue and good and remember virtue and good, then that's something which is really special. I was talking to Betty Jenke the other day, and she was talking to me about this, you know, this thing called the chit, the memory. I must have said I asked her this question because I didn't really understand what she was saying. She said a really interesting thing. She said sometimes we score the defects of others in our memory. We're just sitting there in a subtle memory. And she said it's like a subtle vibration. I think it's true. And people can feel that sense that I are still in my memory track. And she was saying the depth of effort required to eliminate that from my memory track. Because people won't get those clean feelings from me. You know, those pure feelings, those really loving feelings, if I've got this subtle sort of imprint of your defects in my memory track. A very, very subtle thing. I think, you know, it manifests as, you know, seeing defects as criticism. I always feel that when I even have this mental criticism, you know, mental criticism for others, then people really do feel that, you know, and it doesn't really allow me to have the experience of that deep love from the hearts of others, because the karmic return of mental criticism is I really lose the love from the hearts of others. Even cynicism, you know, sometimes I think cynicism is such a powerful thing in this world, isn't it? Especially in some places, less in other places, but it's seen as intelligence, and yet, you know, we would see it as very, very superficial, where I'm sort of cynical. So ego, you know, it manifests in so many different ways. And I think also sometimes, you know, as we're learning, as we become familiar with others and we're learning about myself, one of the things I really learned is how my experiences from the past overlay and create reality in the present. But it's actually not reality at all, it's just my own experience from the past which overlays on the present. And by that I really mean that it's almost like my whole perception of reality is distorted by my karma and my sense scars. And one thing I've noticed a lot is that, like I was saying earlier on, the need to belong is really powerful. And one of the greatest sensitivities, and I think most souls, is the sense of not belonging or even rejection. You know, one of the things which hurts most is the sense of being rejected. And that can come through many subtle things. And you know, I think in the past we have been rejected many times. And so the littlest thing in the present brings up the whole history of rejection from the past. I remember one sister in Australia telling me that she had an experience in her childhood where she, you know, was sent away to boarding school when she was 3 years old, I do believe, and her parents were on the other side of the world. And this was, and she, anyway, one thing happened in the center and she reacted tremendously. Someone just said something so light to her. There was such a huge reaction in her that even later talking to her about it, she realized it was almost like the whole history of the past was there like a wound inside, and just a little touch on it opened the wound, and she overreacted to this person just asking her a little thing. And so sometimes we are trying to reform a harmonious, unified family, and yet the one with wisdom will always see myself and what I need to change. Because what I think is that when we go through this period, we come to a point, another phase, I think, which is a real phase of acceptance. And to me, this is beautiful spirituality where, you know, I just learn to accept myself, where I'm at. I'm in the process of change. I've left the Iron Age. I've stepped away from the Iron Age, but I'm still not in the Golden Age yet. I'm still sort of trekking through the Copper Age or the Silver Age somewhere. Sometimes I'm in all courses. But one foot in the Iron Age, one in the Golden Age, and a bit in between. It's like all bits are there. And I think it's like, you know, this sense of acceptance. And to me, the huge shift when it's as a whole family, we all begin to understand together, I am responsible for how I feel. To me, that is such an important thing. When a collective group of people know, in a community, I'm totally responsible for my sort of well-being in relationships and things. I'm completely responsible. So rather than pointing the finger, I know that whenever there's a reaction in me, it's something within me, even if the person who triggered it. We hear it 1,000 times, but I think we forget this time and time again. And I think then we begin to see that giving respect to each other, I feel, is such a subtle thing. And I remember once thinking, you know, I remember bothering the Sakamolis. I remember even Daddy Janky telling us that when Baba first started, his first teaching was that, you know, children never put impurity into action. You know how? And to break the cycle of pure impurity and the level of action. And this was sort of at the beginning of the Yagya, what Baba began to teach. And then later, and especially when Baba became Avyakt, he began to talk about, you know, breaking the cycle of impurity. Even in thoughts, you know, even the karma of thoughts. But now I feel it's like all of Baba's teachings is about feelings and understanding the effect of feelings. Because to me, you know, respect is not so much verbal. It's all about the subtle, the most subtle vibrations and feelings that I can have. And I think you would have read a lot about communication. When I was reading about it, one of the things that always fascinated me was that when we communicate, there's always three levels that you're, when you talk to anybody, you relate to anybody, you interact with anybody, there's three levels working. One is what you see. Secondly, the feelings, the vibes. What do we say, the vibes we give off? And thirdly, it's like the expressions or the current lingo is body language. And all that communicates to another person what's deep inside me. And what research has shown is that if you give one message through what you say, if people get a different message by what they feel, they always trust what they feel. And that really means you can say the loveliest things, oh, you're such a nice soul, and oh, you're doing such good service, and you're great, and you're all this. I've got another subtle thing in my mind. And we know in the family, smart at that, you know. And that's why it's almost purity of attitude, purity of feelings, cleanliness of feelings. And that's why I think, you know, that is giving us such an education to create this respect of how to give regard to one another. And this constant theme over the last few years, children have good wishes and few feelings. Does Baba ever not say it in the Muli? I think every Muli, he says it in a different form, doesn't he? Because when it's there, the other will have a sense of respect for me. It's almost like I see their virtue, I connect with their virtue, I connect with their goodness, I'm relating to the positive part of you. It's such an important thing. And I think also that having merciful feelings for each other. You know what I've noticed is that sometimes, I think all Brahmins, one of the great sanskaras that we have in common is we have mercy. We're very merciful. And I think we feel for the world and how the state of the world. Sometimes I think it's very easy, you know, to read in the newspapers about all the things happening on the other side of the world, all the terrible things, and you think, you know, you really feel compassion and mercy. But I wonder how much we extend it to those I live with. you know, and I work it on a daily basis. To me, if I can have merciful feelings and understanding, real understanding, because sometimes, you know, I think we look at other souls and sometimes they're really bright and happy, and then we go through things, you know, in Brahman life, sometimes we go through a period where we're a little confused, we're trying to sort out something, we're trying to understand something. And when we're like that, we can be a little bit abrupt, a little bit, how can I put it, a bit peculiar, a bit odd. And then sometimes people begin to react. That is the very time that others need my goodwill and my mercy when they're going through a little bit of a difficult period, and I show understanding and compassion rather than judgment. And I think that, you know, when we mature, it's yet another form of respect. You know, sometimes I, in my experience, I, you know, when the family, when I used to observe someone having a bit of a hard time with Maya, and we all know, I think, the face is a bit long, and we all know we can read it. You know, we want to help. I think we all want to help in some way. And I think there's different ways of helping. I think in my early days, I used to probably more like emotional support, where you keep talking and encouraging. And not that I'm important, but spiritual support to me is something which is really special. I think spiritual support to me is a little bit like you just, even from a distance without saying something, you really have good feelings and faith in that soul that they will conquer the obstacle that they're facing. And you know, sometimes I think true respect is having faith in others. You know, sometimes when I first, you know, sort of began, I suppose, living in the centre and people go through things, I think sometimes we try to fight my battles better. You know, we want to help so much. You know, respect is actually really having such faith in another that you have the strength, you have the power to deal with this. And you have that goodwill, even from a distance, for another. And I think that spiritual support, it's like deep faith. Yesterday, Jensen was talking about trust and faith and trust. And I remember some years ago in Australia, we had a workshop about faith and trust, and we ended up having an ongoing series of discussions, and it was called the Frust Group. We combined the faith and trust with Frust. We manufactured our own word for it. But just having that faith and trust in each other. And so they're all, I think, different forms of respect. And what I think is that, you know, maybe when we're young, it's a bit superficial. We go through that familiar period. We may go through these conflicts and upheavals with others. We come to the point where I take responsibility and I begin to accept everyone. And I think that's a beautiful spiritual maturity. Without that, I do think a true respectocracy, if I can call it that, is born, whereby no matter what, I give regard. Just like, you know, Baba, it's like it's a part of my framework, it's a part of my makeup. To me, it's a part of an elevated soul. Is that, yes, I do know you have weaknesses like me, but I'm going to give regard to you. And you know, I've often observed, if another soul has a weakness, if another soul has a shortcoming, how do we deal with it? You know, I've observed, and I don't know what your life experience is, but my life experience is that unless the person who talks to you about your weakness has such deep love for you, most of us get hurt by someone saying, and it has to be such profound and total love. Correction really, really works. Even though maybe we should all be strong enough to handle it, but in reality, I don't know whether we do. But what I've observed is when even someone makes a mistake, someone is having a difficult time, to give love and respect, that inspires them to change. I really believe that actually respect touches something in them and they want to become better. I think when you criticize somebody and say, look, what you behaved like this, most of us become defensive. It's human nature at the moment. But when you show sex, even you know you've made a mistake and someone shows you love, you want to become better and you want to change. I think that's about this message. What it shows is just constant love. And it's the lack of love and respect which helps us create our own self-respect. I remember talking with Ken about this too. We were just talking about, you know, how do we really regain self-respect? And, you know, there's a thousand things, and you can read a thousand things, but I honestly feel that the main ingredient is to experience others' love and respect. You know, the whole foundation of regaining my self-respect is to really allow myself to experience others' love. That's the great power which brings me back into that state. Because I feel all the service we're doing, we do thousands of different forms of service, and yet there's one that's more powerful than any form, and that is, I would say, respect and unity in the Brahman family. Because I can tell you, people can see it. People aren't silly. When they come into our gathering, they can tell, okay, we can too, we can see. I find at the retreat centers, you know, in Australia, one of the things which people comment most on, you know, you can have a full weekend of lectures and talks and workshops, but still, what do people notice? It's us. They will always say, oh, you know, I really like the way you people work together. Or they comment on the atmosphere, you know, and that's what I think our service, you know, when we learn, one of I think I have to do is just learn this wonderful art of giving respect to the other. No matter what, this is, I think, a part of Brahman life. And finding what's good in people, communicating to that point, and maintaining respect in regard. People are playing roles, even if they're making mistakes. My respect will help them get better. Telling them what's wrong with them actually helps them get worse most of the time, I think. And that's the whole basis of that being appreciative inquiry, is that actually people improve when you appreciate. And when you are saying, there's a problem, there's a problem, there's a problem, they seem to get worse. I just think that it's such an important thing to learn. And what I've noticed in myself, because I've paid a lot of attention to it, I observe myself not having proper respect for somebody, down, there's a little bit of disappointment, you know? And I know the truth is to give regard to all, you know? When you fall into the old habit of sort of maybe not having the vision on somebody, I know I should. There's a little bit, the main thing I think is we become a little bit disappointed with ourselves, because the other way, and we know deep down truth, is to give regard to all. And that's the way I think we such great service, because if you look at religions in the world, they disrespect each other. And that's the great conflict in the world. You know, in families, in relationships, so much disrespect. And yet, we follow a very disciplined way of life, and yet God says, wherever you go, give regard. I remember there was one sister in Melbourne when we first opened the center, and she actually, this is like a baby came in 1977, and she had a happy yoga school in Melbourne, and she was from India. Her name was Shanti. And she invited everybody to her happy yoga school. And I remember when we arrived at the receptive energy, she's a very sweet soul. She had sort of her white sari on. She had, you know, she was made up to the hilt, you know. She was just completely made up, like she was a fashion model, you know, and she had her white sari on, everything like this. Perhaps I remember my superficiality. I thought, oh, God, look at that. She doesn't really fit a white sari. But Daddy gave her such deep respect, you know. It was like, She didn't see anything, you know, not like me. You know, she just saw the soul, and she was so uplifted by Daddy's presence. And I even remember one other sister in New York when once I was there, and she's Australian, and she works in New York, and she's an astrologer, and she's just gone to position in New York. And once again, she came to see Daddy Jenki in New York, and she said to me that she'd been to class, and she used to attend the Moolies, but she was going on television, and she had sequins all over her face, and I mean, she was just in this amazing outfit, you couldn't believe. And she said to me, oh, I wonder what Daddy will think when she sees me like this, you know. And yet, she just said to me, Daddy didn't see that, she just saw the soul and gave her love, and she really appreciated, you know, just not being superficial on all these sort of, just giving regard to the soul, I think is such a power. In Brother's vision, he has such regard, we're all uplifted. And when my vision, I think, is such of respect, learning that wonderful art, I think we create an amazing atmosphere within the Brahman family, and there's nothing more serviceable. It just attracts. I've just seen myself in centers I go to where there's that regard given, it just seems to grow easily. And yet, it's really, it's me, isn't it? I have to learn that deep art. And I think it takes time. I think I need to give myself time to really, you know, create such a vision, you know, such an attitude, such words of respect for others. It's a little bit of time. Anyone wants to make any comments or ask any questions or share any experiences or whatever? I don't know whether anyone here would be curious about that. I don't think so, really. She was at asking, she said English isn't her first language, so is there a difference between regard and respect? To be frank, I've never thought of it as very sort of interchangeable words. But maybe someone has thought about it and... That's lovely, yeah. Yeah. Elizabeth is just saying, regard is something you hold, of course, in your memory, just in a way, for something, but respect is something you see. It's like a vision. It's amazing, isn't it? I've often thought the most powerful things are our eyes, you know? Because I just think our vision, you know how powerful my vision is in myself, you know? It's such a powerful thing. Same with others. You know, our vision is so powerful. And I think that when my vision is clean, it's such an extraordinary tool to uplift. That's what I feel. And I do find that when you're around those really pure souls and their vision is clean, I think everyone's uplifted by a soul that's that inner cleanliness and it radiates. It's beautiful. I'll tell you frankly, I didn't catch it all myself. Because she talked about it in one of her classes over there, and then I asked about it afterwards, and I didn't fully understand it. So I plan to ask her once again. But it was sort of as far as I understood, there was something different from sanskars. And I suppose it pertains to the conscious memory of this life. Because we have... The sanskars have all the impressions of past actions, but in this birth, they haven't a chit, it's like a long tape, which is a memory of all the things that have happened in this life. And I think what has happened is that imprinted into that memory sometimes is another's mistakes and weaknesses and that sort of stuff. And sometimes hardly, it may not even flash up into your consciousness. Because it's sort of imprinted there, people will sometimes still get that vibration from me. Because I think my experience is that most human souls, not all, but especially Brahmins, we're very sensitive. And even though that's my weakness in one sense, to be oversensitive to a negative vibration of another, we have to learn to deal with that. We can't blame others, but still, it's almost like I'm careful what feeling people are getting from me. I've heard Daddy say she always wants to leave every soul with just a lovely feeling, you know. And, you know, it's just, so even if that is sort of stamped on my my chit, my memory tape. It's a subtle sort of energy that's still existing in my mind, and I suppose people can still feel that. Or even maybe it's like a filter that my vision goes through, so it's not that real cleanliness of vision. Mm. Almost like that, I suppose. Yeah. But as I say, I haven't fully understood myself, and I intend to ask her if there's a chance at some stage. Yeah, Roy. Mm. I'm glad you said that. Roy was saying that she's talking about it because nobody fully understood it. That's great, because sometimes when you ask her, she will develop a way of describing it in a way that we can understand. That's with much more clarity, because I could feel like it was a very, very subtle thing that she was discussing. Yeah, I mean, it depends on the context, like everything. You know, sometimes we put together as a service group to work together, and then someone decides that it's not going in the way they want. And I would always encourage to keep going, you know. Learn, stay with it. I always think it's healthy to stay with things. I think the best way is not to give up and sort of leave. Drawing sometimes is sort of, some people can use it as a way to get their own way, but I even remember once, there was one sister in a center, and I know a lot of the people in that center weren't particularly happy with her, and I remember they said, they told Daddy once again, should we, you know, have a change of coordination. I'm sure there's not one center in the world that's had that thought. And they said, no, you know, you've got to all learn. When there's a problem, we just keep sort of saying, oh, let's just change, rather than trying to learn to adjust. And they did adjust, and then actually they got through it. They actually learned to cooperate and work with each other. And I think that sometimes I do feel, that withdrawing from things is, 99% of the time, or a lot of the time, not the best solution. I don't think it is. Silence is a different thing. Sometimes just being quiet is good. And when I say, I'm not participating anymore, I don't want to be involved anymore. That sort of thing. Mm. Just in relation to what Charlie was saying, drawings, that when a situation comes to a soul and feels like a challenge, sometimes there's that feeling that I haven't got the strength within me. And in terms of a point of self-respect, recognizing that even if I don't at that moment recognize within myself the virtue or power that situation does in me, to have that courage in that moment to actually come through on that, and then, in a sense, self-respect in a conscious level will emerge, see it as an affirmation, not as a situation to blow me down. Okay. I've got another microphone. Anyone else want to share anything more? And it's Baba's way, it's always to give respect, to give respect, and to give respect. And even if there is a close custom consistent with Brahman life, it's built on giving regard. And even during the last week of Diwali, did you notice how, the way everyone was given respect? And it's really lovely. It's almost like we're creating that culture now for the future, where it will be natural in us, but we're learning at the moment how to always give respect to the other. So, maybe we can finish with just a few minutes of meditation.
I must be honest, I don't even remember what's on tonight.
In here? Okay, from 6 to 8 again? Okay, that's lovely to you.